Okay, I guess I'm just going to call it the Gulf of Mexico blowout. I know there's a controversy now. They're saying, well, we should make sure BP's name in there and call it the BP spill. I'm not going to go there today. Good morning. I'm Steve Heimel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. And we're talking, of course, about the oil spill and the blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org. The subject, the spill, deja vu all over again on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
So, about 21 years ago, my first guest today was at Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania, running a bird sanctuary. That's where the eagles, the hawks migrate through. And he ends up, before too long, in Cordova, taking care of birds. Stan Senner is now the Director of Conservation Science for the Ocean Conservancy and works down in Portland, but he spent an awful lot of time in Alaska. Stan, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks for having me as your guest today, Steve. It's great to be on the program.
Now, of course, where I got to know you was when you were working for the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council after the spill, and you were the science director, I think, after Bob Spees, right?
I was the science coordinator while Bob Spees was the chief scientist, and I also started out as the chief of restoration planning for the state of Alaska following the spill.
Well, it's great to have you with me, and I think we really want to try to encourage a lot of Alaskans to call every time we go to this subject of the spill that we had, and is certainly thrown in sharp relief now. We find that we get some new insights from the callers, and the telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. And I guess the question is, for our callers, what is the advice? If you went through the Exxon Valdez oil spill, what is your advice to the people along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico? And Stan, you're going to get a chance to go down there. Now, I understand that also with the Ocean Conservancy, Denny Kelso, our former conservation director of environmental commissioner of environmental conservation, is at the spill site right now. And he's, I guess, kind of your boss there at the Conservancy.
That's right. He is the chief operating officer of Ocean Conservancy, and he is one of my bosses. And he is in Louisiana right now, meeting with public officials, taking a look at the spill area, and but also meeting with fishermen and Sea Grant people and people directly affected by the spill, real people who are experiencing what so many Alaskans experienced more than 20 years ago.
Is the Ocean Conservancy, Stan, one of the organizations that is behind this full-page ad that came out today basically urging Secretary Salazar not to let Shell drill in the Chukchi?
Yes, Ocean Conservancy is one of the sponsors of that ad, and our basic view on that is straightforward, and that is that this is the event in the Gulf is, we think, a game changer. It points up the risks in offshore drilling, and it's something that we need to step back, take stock of this issue much more carefully before anyone makes a decision on whether or not to proceed with exploratory drilling in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas.
Well, of course, they did pay all that money for those leases, the most money ever laid out for offshore leases in Alaska, if you don't discount for inflation. But still, a couple billion dollars, it's quite a lot of money. It would seem that they need to find out what's out there somehow. What are you thinking? Maybe that seismic would be okay, but maybe not the exploratory drilling yet?
I think it's just simply premature to approve an exploratory drilling program without further assessing risks. They have done some seismic work out there. Certainly there is the potential to do some more, but to actually be punching holes in the the seafloor, I think, is premature until everyone has let the dust settle a little bit from this Gulf experience. And I think that's going to be a long time because, as you know, they haven't even begun to have success at stopping the flow of oil.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in fairness, Stan, the depths are quite different. And I think the technology for drilling at this depth, even in the Arctic, don't you think it's quite a bit better established than this deep water technology that they're having so much trouble with?
I think that the depth issue is relevant, and certainly there is less pressure involved in drilling at these shallower depths. However, Steve, the fundamental problem, I think, or one of them, is whether the blowout preventers actually work.
Whoa,
and,
yeah.
You know, if you look at the this incident in the Gulf, it was a failure of blowout preventers. If you look at the Australia experience a year ago, it was a failure of blowout preventers. If you go back to 1979 and the Ixtoc spill in the Gulf of Mexico, which was 100 million gallons of oil, that was a failure of blowout preventers. And so the shallower depths in the Chukchi and the Beaufort do not give me much comfort that we have fully evaluated the risks, that we have the technology to drill safely. And one additional point, they're struggling to mount a decent response effort in the Gulf of Mexico. I can't imagine how we would do the same were that necessary in the Arctic. We just don't have that capacity.
Yeah. Well, Stan, you know, neither you nor I is a roughneck or an expert on blowout preventers, but you would think that something that was invented in 1922 might have been perfected by now, wouldn't you?
Well, I agree with you, Steve, and I think one of the troubling things that I've read reports about, and I only know here what I'm reading in the news media, is that there was a $500,000 additional device, I guess a remote switch to activate blowout preventers that Minerals Management Service and BP chose not to go with this deep water well. And I think that $500,000 cost would seem like a pretty good investment right now, given what the ultimate costs of this disaster are likely to be.
Yeah, we're speaking with Stan Senter. He is Dr. Stan Senter, the Director of Conservation Science at the Ocean Conservancy, joining us from Portland, but shortly to be traveling to the site of the Gulf spill himself. His boss, Denny Kelso, who many Alaskans will remember, is already down there consulting with fishermen and scientists and so forth. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. An email is talk@APRN.org. And I think Stan and I both were there for the Exxon Valdez spill. He arrived shortly afterwards. I got there a couple of days afterwards. And it is eerie, don't you think, Stan, to see similar patterns once again. It just seems that a lot of the same things that happened at Exxon Valdez that we thought maybe we would learn from, maybe we really didn't learn from.
You're right, and your title for the program, the deja vu all over again, certainly rings true. One of the starting points for that conversation is the reports that you know, they don't have adequate boom, for example, in place nearby. And I read early on that they needed fire, what they called fire boom, for some of this burning they were planning to do. And the nearest fire boom was several states away. And
whoa.
So this is very discouraging because we're in a region in the Gulf of Mexico that has a of course, a long history of oil and gas activity, and one would think if there's any part of the country where they would have all the response equipment and capacity right there in place at the ready, it would be this region, and it's sounding like that's not the case.
Well, they did finally run down some fireproof boom because they did do some burning. I know that was also an issue with the Exxon Valdez. Some say that there was quite a bit more potential to burn, but there were, for various reasons, it wasn't done. And one of them was that they weren't able to get the spill boomed off from the tanker.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And those are probably some good questions for Denny Kelso, who was really literally on the scene for some of that. But my recollection is there were lots of questions initially about dispersants and, you know, where those were located and whether they were in sufficient quantity. And then there was they wanted to look at the burning issue, and there were problems, as you say, with safety and booming it away from the vessel. And then what was it? 4 days into the spill, the wind started blowing, and then the whole game changed.
Yeah, very much so. Well, it's a pleasure having you with us. Our telephone number 1-800-478-8255, and we're talking about the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and especially as it relates to the Exxon Valdez spill. One thing that I noticed, and it's almost, I get this feeling as a journalist that I can almost predict the next turn of the story. And for instance, you know, when they were talking about putting this big dome over top of the wellhead, you know, I was saying, okay, and then the next story is going to be when it doesn't work. And sadly, that was true. But it just seems that too often the media is like one step behind. It's very hard for them to look ahead. The story seems to totally morph from day to day. And that's very much like what happened with the Exxon Valdez.
You're right, and I gather in the case of the efforts to stop this flow of oil in the Gulf, first it was the dome. Now they're talking about the top hat. I think that's the term I saw, which is apparently a much smaller kind of a structure. And then the third piece is this what they're calling the junk shot, which they've been talking about golf balls and shredded materials and other stuff. I must say that does not inspire a lot of confidence, but maybe there's an angle there that will work.
Yeah, the idea is you have, I guess, a somewhat functional junction at the blowout preventer, and what they need to do, what apparently is, as I understand it from oil people, what is problematical is if you stop the back pressure that is in the riser right now down at the bottom of the ocean, that's, you know, like a mile of pipe leaking oil but still under pressure, and if that pressure is relieved even that deep, that might change the rate at which the oil can come out at the wellhead. So they're trying to plug that up.
Yep.
It's fairly simple physics, but at that depth, apparently nothing is simple, and a whole lot of things are quite different than what we think. Like, for instance, the formation of ice crystals around methane and the expansion and contraction of this weird thing called a clathrate and a hydrate. I mean, it's driving me crazy. I'm not a physicist, and I thought physicists understood it, but apparently the physicists and the engineers might not have been communicating too well. Let's put David on from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, David.
Well, that's my question about the hydrates. They occur at certain depths and temperatures, low temperatures. So my question is, they played a role in the blowout here. They were thought to have caused the blowout, actually. Do we have hydrates in the Chukchi because it's the Arctic? And are those likely to be a risk there as well? That's my question.
All right. Stan, do you know if they have found hydrates in those subsurface there?
I do not know the answer to that question. I wouldn't want to speculate. It wouldn't surprise me, but I don't know the answer.
Yeah, David, I don't think I do know this much, and I think Stan would agree with me on this. It was not until the lease sale that the Minerals Management Service had the money to fund a really coordinated study of the baseline of the Chukchi. And that's been some really amazing research, but I haven't heard too much about whether they have found those hydrates in the Chukchi or not. So we don't have a good answer for you yet, David.
Well, all I know is I read on Wikipedia that they're very dangerous, and I just wonder if that's the next story.
Yeah, I sense that it is, and as a matter of fact, I was trying to book some methane hydrate experts to be on this program, but I just simply could not find the right one, and I think that is where the story is going to go, David.
Well, I think it's an excellent question, and I will also be eager for the answer on that one. But, Steve, I don't think in the case of the Minerals Management Service in the baseline in the Chukchi, I would at least argue that although there has been some terrific science conducted associated with this most recent round of leasing, that in fact there has not been a comprehensive effort to establish an environmental baseline in the Chukchi since the original Outer Continental Shelf Environmental Assessment Program back in the late 70s and early 80s. And I don't think we've seen anything so comprehensive as that in the last 30 years. And so I think that we don't yet have the baseline that is needed to establish whether a drilling program can be done safely or not, and to evaluate the results if something does go wrong.
Yeah, they're a very interesting scientific question, I think, Stan, because they've found it's quite patchy down there, and they found it's quite rich ecologically. I mean, we had the lead scientist on, to describe some of that. It's patchy and it's rich, but they can't do a run of year to year to year and say how much changes from one year to another. But apparently, there are extremely different patches within very close geography.
Yep, and from the standpoint of the necessary environmental studies, one of the difficulties with that kind of patchiness is that you then really have to do your work at a sufficiently fine scale. You have to do work that is both broad and extensive, but also at sufficiently fine scale to capture that kind of patchiness and variability in space, but then also to do it over time, do it at different seasons, but over a period of years. And I don't think that we have that kind of a comprehensive picture in place.
Stan Center is our guest. He is the Director of Conservation Science for the Ocean Conservancy. The organization is one of the groups that is urging Secretary Salazar to not allow exploratory drilling in the Chukchi just yet. And we have been talking about the Chukchi, but let's try and get back down to the Gulf of Mexico. Stan, what is your feeling about the enormous amount of dispersants that are being released along with this crude oil now?
Excellent question. First of all, I think one of the lessons learned from Exxon Valdez is that there is real value in doing just about anything you can to keep the oil from reaching sensitive shorelines, shallow waters, salmon spawning habitat, marshes, that kind of place. And so I put a lot of value on keeping the oil off of the shorelines and the coastal wetlands. And I think that goes in spades in the Gulf of Mexico, where you have vast marshland and wetland habitat that's so important in the life histories of a whole variety of commercially important fish and shellfish, as well as a number of wildlife. Having said that, I think there are a couple dimensions to the dispersant question. Certainly, the use of dispersants on oil on the surface is, I think, a pretty well-established process, and I don't think we have a quibble with that, although we are concerned about the tremendous volume of dispersants that are in use. But the part that has us most concerned right now is the deep water injection of dispersants right at the vent, trying to break up that oil right there. And the first few days after the spill sort of, or the full dimensions of the spill were known, EPA and the other agencies involved authorized on a test basis the use of dispersants right there at the source of the leak. We, the Ocean Conservancy, did not object to doing that on a test basis, but we have not seen any of the results of that work. We don't know how effective it's been in terms of dispersing the oil. We also don't know what they have learned about the fate and effects of the chemical dispersants. Are those dispersants having an impact on marine life out in the open ocean? We don't know the answers. So right now we're kind of in a wait-and-see skeptical mode about any further application of those dispersants in the deep water environment. We have more questions than we do answers right now.
Well, Stan, you're probably going to try and get some answers to those when you go down to the Gulf yourself, relieving Denny Kelso next week.
Absolutely, and we're also not even waiting for that, trying to reach appropriate authorities at EPA and NOAA to see what we can learn, ahead of time. But definitely in a we're in a wait and see mode on that right now.
Let's go to Bruce. Joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bruce.
Hi, I've helped out with oil spill drills here in Homer and heard stories from the Exxon spill from other fishermen, as we're doing the drills. And I was a chemistry major in college, and in grad school I studied food science, and at the College of Fisheries at University of Washington they were studying the effects of some of the components of crude oil that get pumped out of bilges even into Puget Sound and how they cause tumors in the flounders and different things like that. And it never added up to me about this use of dispersants. It doesn't seem right. And we don't have a herring fishery for the last 16 years in Prince William Sound. And there were studies, like I looked at one from Sweden in 1975 on dispersants that were developed after the Torrey Canyon incident in 67 or something like that. The article was in 1975. They said it was 100 times worse. Dispersed oil was 100 times more damaging to herring larvae than just regular oil that was undispersed. So none of the Baltic countries allow the use of dispersants, like Sweden, Finland, Latvia.
So you're saying in the north it might be even more of a problem than down in the Gulf, or tell me?
It might have to. Well, it is. Dispersants are less effective as the temperature goes down.
Yeah.
So, like at the bottom of the ocean, probably the dispersant isn't maybe doing a whole lot. But because it's blended with the crude oil, as it rises to the surface and warms up, it's probably doing more and more dispersing. And that would be good at a certain point. But like he said, maybe that would be all right in deep water, way offshore. But as it gets shallower and can drift around, and it doesn't seem like the tide action and the wave action is really pushing this oil very far, very fast. And so there could be developing fairly large concentrations of the smaller components of the crude oil that include the benzene, naphthalene, anthracene. Those are the three most carcinogenic compounds in the crude oil, and that could be... Now they're in the water, they can go up the food chain. So there's debate among scientists about that, and we're not hearing about this in the news.
No.
So I'm kind of challenging the journalism departments to say, put on your science caps and start looking into this a little bit. I think this needs to be examined.
I think Stan would agree with you. Thank you very much for that, Bruce from Homer. Stan, just a factual question about the Prince William Sound herring. Was Elizabeth Biggs, as she was known at the time, able to get any kind of data on dispersants and the problems she found with the herring?
Steve, there were studies that documented deformities in herring eggs that were exposed to oil, and reduced survivorship of herring produced from eggs exposed to oil. So there was work on the oil itself. I do not recall in the context of Exxon Valdez that there was specifically work on dispersant chemicals and their effects on the herring. And you know, and you may remember some of this better than I do, the most invasive part of the response and cleanup effort in Exxon Valdez was the hot water, high pressure cleaning on the beaches, which wasn't so much chemical dispersant as it was simply the high pressure and the hot water. And my recollection is that dispersant use was more limited in Exxon Valdez, but I may be off base on that, but I don't think it was on the massive kind of scale we're seeing in the Gulf, and I share the questions and concerns that Bruce raised.
Yeah. Bruce, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Brad, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Brad.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon to you. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Well, yes, I guess I woke up early this morning, but this issue with the outer continental shelf, it really touches a string in my heart, and especially here, I'm at the Alaska Intertribal Council, and so if you go to AITC.org, www.AITC.org, you can go, and right on the front page of the website are resolutions, you know, asking for time, and really, we need the time. When we look at oil, from a universal perspective, and there's a fixed number of barrels of oil on this earth. And every time, every day that we use a barrel of oil, of course, there's less available. So henceforth, that oil is worth more. Now, as we develop technology and improve our education and our access to these resources, this oil is, of course, becoming more valuable each day. So I think that we need to allow for our children to make these decisions for us. And we have the luxury of waiting 100 years, 500 years, and erring really on the side of caution. That oil is in the ground. We know where it's at. We can bank on that, literally.
All right, Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Of course, Shell wouldn't see it that way because they have to show due diligence on their leases. They only have leases for a certain length of time, although they do have a way of getting extended, as we saw with the Point Thompson situation. Stan Center, I know you're gonna need to leave me, and so I wanted to give you a chance for the parting shot here. Any relationships that you see or things that you wanted to kind of flag that we should be watching out for in this Gulf spill?
Well, I do think we all are really eager to see how the science unfolds, and let's hope that agencies like NOAA are able to field an aggressive science program and marshal the baseline data that they've got and really help us understand what this spill is doing in that environment and what the long-term effects are going to be. And I, my heart goes out to the people who've experienced Katrina and so many other, you know, events. And now to be hit with an oil spill, it's got to be very discouraging. And the very least we can all do is help them understand what's happening and be clear about what kind of a restoration program is going to help bring some sort of healing to that region.
Stan, you might have missed it, but I guess Secretary Salazar came out this morning and basically is going to throw more money and resources and enforcement beef into the OCS programs, about as far as he went this time around.
I knew there was an announcement this morning. He's also talking about some reforms within the Minerals Management Service to separate, I think the phrase I heard was to separate the leasing from the policing. I thought that sounded pretty good. And the very fact, though, that Secretary Salazar is moving ahead to identify reforms within the Minerals Management Service before the dust has even settled from this Gulf event, this to me just reinforces the uncertainty about whether wise decisions have been made in the Chukchi. And if the Secretary is already calling for a reorganization of the agency that made those leasing decisions, I think we need to really, really be careful before going ahead with an exploratory drilling program this summer.
All right. Thank you so much, Dan Center of the Ocean Conservancy.
I'm glad to be here, Steve. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe we can check back with you when you get back from the Gulf of Mexico. You'll probably have an interesting update for us. Or maybe we'll
I'd be delighted to do it, and maybe we can get Danny and me on the same program.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Well, let's try and do that. Thank you, Stan. Well, it's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about deja vu all over again, separating the leasing from the Poe leasing, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about that spill in the Gulf of Mexico and what Alaskans have to say about it. And we got a bunch of callers lined up. We were just with Stan Center, former Alaskan with the Oil Spill Trustee Council, and now with the Ocean Conservancy down in Portland. Dr. Center is on his way down to the Gulf of Mexico, and Denny Kelso is there right now. He is also with the Ocean Conservancy. And joining us now by telephone from his home on Government Hill is Charles Wolforth, the author of The Fate of Nature. Charles, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve, although I'm in West Anchorage, not Government Hill. But nice to hear Stan's voice again. He was a lot of oil spill veterans developed some friendships back in those years, so it's nice to kind of reconnect with them.
Yeah, it really is. I think we had you on our show when we on the anniversary of the spill, did we not, as I recall?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here we are with deja vu all over again, and we'll probably go over a lot of the same territory here. But it does seem, as you watch the media accounts, that this has probably given your book a bit of a boost, even though it hasn't actually hit the stores yet.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's ironic and that my writing career got its original boost from the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and now my new book is coming out right as this spill is taking place. And so I've seen my work syndicated across the country and have received a lot of interview requests. I was on the Russian television yesterday via Skype from my office. So it is kind of deja vu in that sudden intense interest from the media that takes place, and a lot of the same questions, and in a lot of the same sort of outrage and reaction, and lots of people trying to learn a lot quickly in a learning curve.
Yeah, and you know they got deadlines and they don't have much time, and you're pretty handy research form right now. You might as well exploit it as much as you can, Charles.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because as you and I both know, it won't be long before they'll be off to some other story, and it'll be hard to, you know, there won't be too many people actually working this thing. Although I'll probably more than work the Exxon Valdez, which was basically just you after a while.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary thing, you know, that after the national media took off is really that what kind of events happened. Well, the oil left the Sound, it hit Kenai Fjords National Park, it hit Kodiak Island in the Alaska Peninsula. Exxon mobilized more than 10,000 people, built hotels and equipment out in the Sound, floating hotels and hospitals, and all this extraordinary stuff was going on, and I was working for the Anchorage Daily News. They'd bought a boat for me to get around in, and 99% of the time I was the only journalist out there, and that is a strange comment about how we get information. And you, now the attention span is even shorter with the internet and cable news and all the changes that have happened. So you kind of wonder, is a celebrity going to die and everybody stops paying attention to this? Back in 89, there were, you know, we had Tiananmen Square happened. We had the fall of the Berlin Wall. There were a few big stories that year. So you couldn't really blame the media too much. But at the same time, if this BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico keeps going on for months and months, will they keep with it? You know, because probably the majority of the damage hasn't happened yet. So the story really, we really don't know the most important parts of the story yet.
Yeah, you know, I just, it's I think you and I, you know, had a similar reaction when we first heard about this, so we didn't even want to look at it. We didn't want to know about it. But then it kind of, for me at least, it's sort of going the other way, is I just can't get enough information, and I get really frustrated that I'm not getting the good information, and I really want to be down there asking the questions myself and grabbing lapels and hanging around outside of doors and trying to overhear things and so forth like that to try and piece this together, because we got an awful lot of questions right now, don't you think, Charles?
I'm frustrated. You know, one of the basic questions is, well, how much oil is spilling? And the people directly involved say 200,000 gallons a day, but that they don't really know. Outside experts are saying that on the surface of the ocean, it looks like a lot more than that, maybe five times as much, but that the Coast Guard and Exxon refused to release video of the actual wellhead where the oil is coming out, where these outside experts believe they could refine their estimates. So, boy, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? How much oil spilled? We still really don't know how much oil spilled from Exxon Valdez either. And it is a super critical question legally, public information-wise, you know, and how people react to this politically. And then also in evaluating the success or failure of the cleanup, because, you know, if they pick up 100,000 gallons of oil and only 200,000 spilled, that's a fantastic success. If a million gallons spilled, well, it's kind of insignificant. So that's another really big question that has not been answered.
Well, that's really interesting about the official sources, because one thing that has changed is a lot better internet now, and we have this outfit SkyTruth, and just as after Katrina, they had the remote sensing information. You could go and, you know, Google Earth right down to it and actually see. It's the same that's going on now. SkyTruth is actually telling us more about the spill than the official sources sometimes.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's sort of similar after Vietnam. The military got savvier about handling the media after Exxon Valdez. I think the Coast Guard and the industry are a little bit savvier, too, that they are putting on a better media face, but some of the critical information they've got, if anything, clamped down tighter than 21 years ago.
I don't think there's any question about it. One thing, for instance, is that we didn't have any eyewitness accounts until about 3-4 days ago, and that has to be partly because BP and Transocean sequestered those people first. And then they must have gone right to their lawyers. Their lawyers must have talked to one another. And then the lawyers basically late last week started leaking stuff. And then all of a sudden the witnesses were talking. And that's vastly different from the Exxon Valdez.
Right. Yeah, there was a pretty shocking story on All Things Considered last night about the workers who were taken off the rig were sequestered for more than 24 hours, not even allowed to tell their families that they were okay. And the first person they got to talk to was a lawyer handing them a form, having to do with, no, I wasn't injured, everything's okay. And I just think that's outrageous and very disturbing. And, you know, it smacks of kidnapping, you know, that you sequester these people, keep them away from anybody who could ask questions, essentially against their will. They're stuck on a boat somewhere.
Right, and the other thing is similar to the Cordova thing is they immediately went in there and started handing out money and getting people to sign things for the use of their vessels, not realizing they were signing rights away at the same time.
Yeah, you hate to see this sort of thing, but you know what I've been trying to let people know is that this, you know, the way we've set up the way that our governmental and natural resource system, this is the way it's going to happen until we start looking at it in some different ways, that you've got a private company that has enormous liability that's hitting it right now. If you don't expect them to do everything in their power to protect their financial interests and their stockholder interests, then you're very naive. And that's exactly what they're doing. That's what they did in Exxon Valdez. And if that's how we want the system to work, that's the results we should expect.
1-800-478-8255 is our phone number. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Charles Wolforth, the author of The Fate of Nature, and he was a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. He was kind of a cub reporter, and this was like the story of his life. He managed to spend much of the summer out there and track the spill like no other reporter. Let's go to John in Dillingham. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John. John, you still there?
Good morning. Yeah, good morning. My suggestion would be to clamp the casing and then cork off the leaks with maybe a soft metal. And that's about all I have to say.
In other words, to bring in, beyond the BOP, to go in there onto the casing and use some other form of pressure, some giant C-clamp or something?
Yeah, like clamp the casing and then, like a cork on a bottle, just clamp it with soft metal, maybe lead or bronze or something.
Yeah. All right, John, I'm sure the engineers are looking at every possible option right now. And a lot of it, following the technical part of it, it seems to be like, what actually can we inject in there that'll slow this down and not make it worse? And I guess it's a real complicated problem in physics at that depth.
One of the things that I see that's similar to Exxon Valdez, Steve, is that the sequential trying of something new, sort of this process of improvisation, which is going on, which it wastes a lot of time. You know, you try one thing, it doesn't work, then you think, oh, well, let's try something else. Okay, well, we better start building the equipment to try that. Okay, well, that'll be another week. Then we have to get it out there. If you really had properly planned and were prepared for every eventuality, this kind of equipment would be ready, and you would have done the research to figure out how you'd accomplish it rather than sort of do one improvised solution after another. And that would require funding, university, independent researchers and engineers for really expensive work to look at this. And that wasn't done. Oil spill research has been reduced, and we don't have an institute that does that kind of work. So that's what we're left with in this situation, is that, they do try something, it doesn't work, they try something else, they keep saying, well, this has never been done before, we don't know how to do it. Well, the next question is, well, why don't you know how to do it? You wanted to drill the oil, why don't you have the answers?
Yeah, and, that's just the kind of thing that I want to get down there and grab people's lapels and, insist on answers to. But, Charles, it's just interesting if I were there, if I were a reporter engaged in this story, I'd have a million deadlines just like they do, and I'd have to report every single little turn of the story as if it was the be-all and end-all. And so I would have been caught all up in this, they're going to put a giant dome thing. From the distance up here, I could say, well, don't they realize it could plug up? Don't they realize there's a pressure problem? It wasn't that hard to, from the perspective of here. But, boy, the deadline perspective is a very different one.
And the deadline perspectives are a lot worse now than they used to be. When I was writing newspaper stories, I had to file a story every day. But that gave you a full work day to find out what the heck was going on, to develop sources, to get out there and do stuff, to be in the field. Maybe you're filing by a marine radio or whatever, but at least you have a day. And now most reporters are required to file continuously on the web, to blog, to do video blogs, to do audio, to do interviews. They're essentially turning out information continuously. And what that forces them to do is answer one question at a time and be on top of the next moment rather than on top of some of the bigger questions. And that's something that I think is there's a process, and it's not I'm not saying anything negative, but every news source is trying to manipulate the media. They're trying to get their message across the way they want it. And if the reporters are scrambling and don't have any time to get context or to understand the overall picture, then it becomes much easier for the news sources to manage the message.
Let's go to Thomas, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Thomas.
Good morning, Steve. Yeah, I just thought I'd chime in with some FOIA documents that I recently got from the Coast Guard due to Pacific Environment's gracious proffering of those to the Coast Guard. And what we discovered was is that the Coast Guard has adopted policies for remote areas that allows the shippers to, you know, both tank vessels and non-tank vessels, to comply with virtually no equipment capable of operating in the ocean whatsoever. And their excuse is that that these are remote areas without the sufficient infrastructure allowing them to use alternative planning criteria. But the original intent of allowing original alternative planning criteria was to increase the type and amount of equipment necessary to comply for these types of situations where they wouldn't be able to bring in, you know, extra equipment, or the sea conditions were unusually severe or problematic.
So are you talking Gulf of Mexico, Chukchi Sea, Dutch Harbor, or which are you talking, Tom?
They classified, here's what it says. Many captain of the port zones include remote areas where there is a lack of OSRO resources. These areas include Guam, Southeast Alaska, Prince William Sound, Western Alaska, and American Samoa.
It's been everywhere.
Well, that's right. That is the entire state. Southeast Alaska is one captain of the port zone. Prince William Sound is another. And Western Alaska is the rest of the state.
Tom, it seems like they've tried to create a giant loophole for themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And not only did they create this loophole for all of the tank and non-tank vessels, because there's a lot of trans-Pacific traffic going to Canada and the Panama Canal through the Aleutians, the Coast Guard itself is required to provide the response assets for those vessels in innocent passage, and that's about 30% of the traffic. They're supposed to use funds from the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund to buy that equipment and prepare area contingency plans for those vessels, and they refuse to get that equipment themselves. They bought a few pieces of equipment and build the OSLT app for that, but they're not. They don't really have any of those assets in the Aleutian sub-area plan, and they've abandoned their mandate to quote, effectively and immediately respond to oil spills out to the edge of the EEZ, 200 miles out from shore.
Tom, I want to thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, good information. You know, and it that brings up the point that the Point Hope village has made in objecting to the offshore drilling that's going to be starting this summer by Shell Oil. They sent an open letter to the Secretary of the Interior where they talk about the Gulf, the work that's going on in the Gulf, where there are 75 vessels and 1,000 people, and their letter says, if a spill occurred like the one in the Gulf, where would the 75 vessels come from? What about the 1,000 people? And if they're sent from places other than Alaska, where would they be staged? You know, people down south don't understand that, you know, how many hotel rooms are there even on the North Slope? You know, if you had to have thousands of response workers, where would you put them? You know, it's not just a lack of infrastructure, it's a lack of sort of civilization to support this kind of activity. If people want to, I've been writing about this, and I've got stuff on my website, fateofnature.com, fateofnature.com. I've got the Point Hope letter on there, and it's some pieces I've written, and I really feel like, you know, the important point is, in Arctic Ocean and a lot of other places, if you're going to have offshore oil drilling, you're really not going to be able to clean it up. You know, you don't, if you have large oil spills, even in temperate regions, you only get 10%, you know, when you do a cleanup. So either you believe that oil spills are impossible, which doesn't seem to be the case, or you're prepared to accept the consequences of severe environmental damage. And that's the discussion I think that we need to pull back to, is recognizing it's not just a matter of more equipment or better planning. It's a matter of deciding the value of that ecosystem and whether you're going to put that value above oil, because it's one or the other.
Yeah, and then there's the question of if you even know. Charles Woolforth is our guest. He's the author of The Fate of Nature. He covered the Exxon Valdez oil spill for the Anchorage Daily News as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
It's Talk of Alaska, and the subject is oil spills. And boy, I'll tell you, this is one of those we could probably just keep going. I mean, 24/7, if we had the endurance, we could just keep going. I get an email response here from a listener who wishes to remain anonymous, but says, "Hey, I do know the Chuck GC, and you know, there's some scars in the seabed from really enormous icebergs. So we have a deep water problem, certainly in the Gulf of Mexico, and we all recognize that now. But there might be a shallowness problem, the Chuck G. Charles Woolforth. What do you think?"
Yeah, I there's a video, again, it's on my website at fateofnature.com of ice overrunning a drilling island. You know, I don't know how many of your listeners have been on the sea ice, but once you start thinking about oil being under the sea ice or within broken ice, you know, I can't imagine the technology that could clean it up, because the power of moving ice is beyond any human power that exists. I mean, it's simply not something that you can contend with, and that's the environment that's up there. So the water may be shallow, but it's solid. So that's shallow water, but it's solid water, which doesn't make it that much easier.
Let's go to Alicia. Joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Alicia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really agree with what the last caller ended up saying when he was finished about our values. Well, I just wanted to, our values about what is important in the environment and money. I just wanted to say, we all know about BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It's a major environmental disaster. And something that's been on my mind is I've wondered if our government officials have thought about taking action to stop the spill from reaching the shore by using the Navy fleet, use the ships, placing booms. Anyway, this is a job for the U.S. Navy, is my thinking anyway. And, you know, it may be a part of our future that our military forces will be utilized for our environmental problems.
Alicia, I want to thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Charles Woolforth, as I recall, the Navy did bring a vessel in, and it was among the more effective spilled oil recovery vessels.
Yeah, the Navy had several vessels responding to Prince William Sound oil spill from Exxon Valdez, and they did have some effect, and there was also that huge Russian skimmer that came from the Soviet Union. But the problem is, though, I mean, you throw more equipment at it, and you have to do everything you possibly can. But, I mean, we're talking now about a spill that's endangering the entire Gulf Coast and maybe even the East Coast if it goes around Florida. And, you know, the scale of nature is too large. You can't defend every single piece of coastline. There's just not that much of equipment, and if you were by some miracle able to put boom all the way across the coast of the Gulf of Mexico, then the next storm that comes along, all those booms are going to be knocked out of place again, and the oil is going to go over them, because booms really only work in mild sea conditions. So in that sense, you know, it's I hate for people to get their hopes up too much about these defenses. You know, the first big blow that comes, the oil goes over the booms and the booms are knocked down.
Let's go to Ken, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ken.
Anchorage or Eagle River?
Oh, okay. Eagle River.
Okay. Yes, I've boated out in the Sound for 31 years, and I did work the oil spill in the summer of 89. And, you know, because of some emotional attachment, of course, to the Sound, the lesson has been lost again, and that's that in an oil spill, it's prevention. There's just really and truly no way to clean up the mess. Now, of course, our oil here is more tarry and waxy and tougher to clean up, and it was colder water. But the whole lesson of prevention was obviously lost in the lessons that I learned from the spill. And the second side of the coin that I would definitely warn the people in the Gulf of is that there's a high possibility of another effort of, let's say, a Vico-style Bill Allen creation again, whereby the media, and it's probably already taking place with their teams of lawyers and publicists, et cetera, to manipulate the public's attention. You know, our attention span is limited. We're going to go away from the disaster and, in fact, start declaring that, hey, it's all cleaned up and nature's doing the rest of the job.
Oh, man, you're giving me a headache.
Yeah, so familiar, right.
Yeah. Good point, Ken. Thank you. Thank you so much, Ken and Eagle River. Let's go to Nuiqsut and Jimmy. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jimmy.
Yeah, good morning. You know, we've been demonstrated from the oil companies down in Coco, Mexico. And now, oil companies always talk about they got the technology to stop the leaks. Now it fails. No, if it ever happened within the Arctic waters, the oil company doesn't have no technology to clean the oil within the underneath the current ice movement within the Arctic Circle. So now we've seen the national disaster. What we've seen, like North Sea or down Prince William Sound, where it's ice-free seas are, but up here in the Arctic Ocean, our sea is all alive. That so many depending on with the way of life we live as the Inuit. So we all know what's going on now. The oil company always said they had technology to do this and that, but, you know, oil company doesn't have no technology to clean the oil within the ice movement within our current waters.
Jimmy, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, you definitely had the last word. Charles Wolforth, thanks for being with us. We'll be on some future show to talk about your book.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. I want to thank Stan Center, and I also want to thank Connie Huff, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, helping unlock Alaska's energy potential, and by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.